Now, you probably have noticed this, but as we're going through this, I just want to show you what's happening here, because what's happening here happens to all of us, most especially believers, but non-believers too. If we trace Joseph's life from the human perspective, it looks like this. And so here's when his father exalted him and gave him the coat of many colors, remember? But then his brothers put him in a pit, and he wound up in Potiphar's house. But then he ran the house for Potiphar. He was exalted once again. But Potiphar's wife lied about him, so now he's in prison. So he's down again. But then in prison, he was so wise that he ran the prison. And actually, we don't need this little curve down here, but finally, we see him running Egypt. Now, looking at this from the human perspective, it just looks like a very interesting, unusual story that you wouldn't expect to be repeated by anybody. But when you look at it from God's perspective, God had something he wanted to accomplish that was in his mind from the days of eternity. And what he wanted to accomplish was to have a people who were his own through whom he would bring the Messiah. And this is the family. So from God's perspective, this is what it's like. See, he knows all this. And this is all just the crazy machinations of man. But God used everything, all of this was used by God to get from this point to this point. And God's intention from eternity was to keep his people alive. And the reason I bring that up is because sometimes in my life, and I would imagine sometimes in your lives, I don't understand why in the world is this happening to me? Why is my life like this? And the more you meditate on it, the more you finally come to the point where you say, why is God doing this to me? And it can help, it can cause you to lose your perspective. Joseph never said, why is God doing this for me, to me? Joseph never lost his faith. And he was the perfect man for God to use in preserving the Jewish people. Never complained, never sinned, even when he had opportunity to. I mean, what percentage of men do you think would have ran away from Potiphar's wife? A lot wouldn't have. No one was there but her. And so we can't always, in fact, most times, we can't see this line. We can't see, looking at this, we can't see this. We see this stuff. But this is faith. This right here is, this line is faith. When you can see through the eyes of faith, you still may not see this, but you know it's something somewhere that God has planned for you. And the best thing you can do is when you find yourself here, is examine yourself. If there's any sin in your life, confess and repent it, and wait on God. And at the proper time, he will exalt you. And that's exactly what's happening in this. That's one of the major things that we learn in the life of Joseph. Trust in God is never misplaced. Anyway, going back to, we just last time finished chapter 41, and We read about how Joseph was the only one who could interpret the dreams that Pharaoh had, and also about Joseph's exaltation. How it's almost comical how Joseph's standing there. He just interpreted the dreams for Pharaoh. He told them what to do about it. And he's standing right in front of Pharaoh. And Pharaoh goes, "Where can we find a wise man?" And there he is right there. And Joseph's authority in Egypt was equal to that of Pharaoh, except in some very major... I mean, Joseph didn't have the authority to declare war. Only the king can do that. He probably did not have the authority to determine the capital punishment. There's certain things that, you know, Pharaoh is still Pharaoh, but Pharaoh said, "Only in the throne will I be, you know, have more authority than you." When Pharaoh rode down the street in his chariot, chariot number two was Joseph. And when Joseph rode down the street in his chariot, as was the custom, people bowed down to him. That's a long way from being in a pit. And I don't know that Joseph knew it. Joseph didn't know any of that was going to happen in his life. What he did know is he could trust God in the pit. Okay, so now we come to chapter 42, and let's just read. I have a little introduction here. The preceding chapter has recorded Joseph's rise to power. Chapter 42 turns to the divine purpose behind his miraculous rise. There's a reason God did this. He didn't do it just so the Jewish people would be exalted and have a king. That's not why he did it. Joseph explained to his brothers the ultimate purpose behind the narratives. And that's what we have to learn to do. We have to learn, all of us, that there's always what we might call a hidden purpose in our lives that we can't see, but God can. And that purpose is what God wants to fulfill in us. And although we may not be able to see the end, moment by moment, we can be faithful to him. And if we're faithful to him moment by moment, trust him even in the difficult times, then when we get to that point, we'll meet God.
Right here. You want to take it back with you, Megan.
Relax. Okay. You need 44. It's in there. During the break, we'll see if we can find it. Okay, just take 44. Okay, so the preceding chapter has recorded Joseph's rise to power. Chapter 42 turns to the divine purpose behind his miraculous rise. By the way, I don't want to say that God doesn't have any purpose for this. I'm not just saying this is a means of getting over here. The whole idea of these valleys, let's call them, is to build our trust. Because if I'm here and I trust God and find myself here, it'll be a little easier for me to trust him when I'm here, because I'll remember what he did for me here. To emphasize the importance of this narrative, there are numerous repetitions in the reporting for the events. Remember, we talked about the concept of repetition for this emphasis for the sake of repetition? Wait. Repetition for the sake of emphasis. And it's a literary technique that the Hebrew writers used. One really good example of it is if you read the life of Abraham and you read the life of Isaac, there are tremendous similarities. I have one commentary that has more than half a page full of similarities in their two lives. They both married beautiful women. They both had a problem lying to a king. They both traveled here. Tremendous similarities. And the reason for that repetition was to mark the point that the promise of blessing would go from Abraham to Isaac. And that's why all those similarities. There's a lot of narratives that happen that are repeated by the people involved because of how important they are. In this case, this narrative is going, the narrative that happened back when they put Joseph in the pit, that whole thing, not in great detail, but it's repeated twice in this chapter. Okay, so moving along. Jacob's brothers are sent to Egypt, verses 1 to 4. Now Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt. And remember, in Canaan, it was the famine now. The famine had begun. Now Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, and Jacob said to his sons, "Why are you staring at one another?" He said, "Behold, I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us from that place so that we may live and not die." Live and not die is a phrase that's repeated over and over and over again in Genesis, because it lays the foundation of the contrast between life and death. Because that's what the Bible really is. The Bible is a book that separates life from death. But Jacob did not send Joseph's brother. Then the 10 brothers of Joseph went down to buy grain from Egypt. But Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, "I am afraid that harm may befall him." And that's understandable, because when Joseph was the youngest son, look what happened to him, and he's afraid that could happen. Benjamin was just a boy. So going to the notes. Now the narrative returns to Jacob. It's been focused on the brothers up to this point for a little while, I think since chapter 37. The narrative returns to Jacob, who had been out of the picture, right, since 37-34. As is frequently the case in biblical narratives, the words spoken at the beginning of a story foreshadow its final outcome. And we can see this in a number of ways here. At the very beginning of this, of what we may call the Joseph stories, what happened to Joseph at the very beginning? He was exalted, right? His father gave him that coat, so forth. What happened to Joseph at the very end? That was a foreshadow. He was exalted. Jacob, sending his sons to Egypt, said to his sons, that should be plural, "Go down there so we may live and not die." Conversely, Joseph later said, "It was to save lives that God sent me." Joseph could see the purpose of God and what was happening. Because bear in mind, if none of this had happened, let's suppose the brothers had not decided to put him in a pit. So he came back with the brothers, and now there's a famine and there's no food. And there was, what, I think about 70 people in that family. Where are they going to get food? Were they going to go up to Pharaoh and say, "Pharaoh, let us live on your land and eat your food"? It's not going to happen. And so, reading, Jacob sent his sons to Egypt and said to them, "Go down there so that we may live and not die." And he meant that literally. So Joseph's words also served to align the deeds of Joseph with the larger themes of the Torah, namely the theme of life, Hayim, and death, Moet. And really, if you know, it's a difficult question, what is the theme of the Bible? Because there are a number of major themes. For example, redemption. the glory of God. The beginning and early history of the Jewish people. There's a lot of major things, but one of them is life and death. And it's introduced right at the very beginning. When God says, you may eat of any tree of the garden, but don't eat of that tree. On the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. And ever since then, there has been this struggle between the forces that would want us to die and the forces that would want us to live. And they're right inside of us, by the way. So what God did was he couldn't allow his people to die from the famine because he had made Abraham a promise. And God is faithful to his promises. So God used Egypt to preserve Israel. That's exactly what he did. He works all things after the counsel of his own will. And Pharaoh himself didn't even know what he was really doing. When he said, bring your family up, and they let them live in the land of Goshen and gave them all the food that they needed. There's no way Pharaoh had any inkling that this all played into the life and the redemption, the life and the ministry of Jesus the Messiah. That was so far, no way did he realize that. But that's what was going on. God was preparing the world for the Messiah to come. Joseph's words also serve to align the deeds of Joseph with the larger themes of the Torah, namely the theme of life and death. And here's from Deuteronomy 30, and I want to tell you about this. You see where it says, I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death. This is Moses, by the way, speaking to the Jewish people. I have set before you, well, actually God speaking through Moses, that I've set before you life and death, the blessing and the curse. So choose life in order that you may live, you and your descendants. Now, who's been to Israel here? Let's see if you saw, you know, you go to Israel, you can't see everything in one trip. But this is what Moses did. He took the Jewish people to a place where there were two small mountains. I don't know how elevated a mountain has to be. I know when the ones around here, they call them foothills. Of course, they're just not big enough to be mountains. So they probably would be considered foothills. And these two foothills, here was one. Magic pen. These two foothills, here was one. Then there was a valley, and then there was the other, come on now, and then there was the other one. And what he did, I made these a little bit too steep, because he had approximately half of the Jewish people stand on one, and approximately half of the Jewish people standing on the other, because he wanted to give them an object lesson. And he said to them, and he pointed it, I set before you life and death, and you choose. You choose whether you're going to live here or here, but live here that you may live. That was some thousands and thousands of years ago, right? When I went to Israel, we went there. They know where it is. I almost fainted. This foothill is plush and green and beautiful. This is like a mound of dirt. Nothing grows there. And I said to myself, God left it that way as a reminder of what he said way back through Moses to the Jewish people. So, I mean, I almost, when I looked at them, I was paralyzed with awe. I really was. Okay, so, and by the way, when it says here Moses is speaking on behalf of God, I call heaven and earth to witness against you today, the you is the Jewish people. But I don't think I would get any argument from any of the evangelical scholars if I said it applies to us today equally. Every choice we make is a choice for life or a choice for death. And we have to be mindful and wise that we choose life, because once something dies, it's gone. Once something dies, it's gone. And I'm not talking about a person actually physically dying. But if God has a ministry for you, something you want to do, and you don't want to do it and turn your back on it, it's gone. It's dead to you. God will have somebody else do it. You remember what Mordecai said to Esther? If you don't do it, someone else will. God will raise someone else up, because Mordecai knew that God would preserve his people. The words of Jacob also align themselves with the greater themes of Scripture. Oh, I read that. Yeah, no, I didn't read this one. Scripture. Namely, the theme of life and death. In doing so, the events that follow are cast as a narrative picture showing the way to return the gift of life that was lost in the garden. In the Garden of Eden, we lost the gift of life. And as a matter of fact, the Bible is our roadmap back to Eden. It's the only roadmap. There's no other book that's ever been written in this world that can get us back there, but this one can. And another thing we have to remember here, in Deuteronomy 30:15, which I've read, listen what it says. So choose life in order that you may live, you and your descendants. Let me ask you a question. Suppose you take one man and one woman who are married. They have some children. Doesn't make much difference how many they have, but they have some children. Their children get married and have children. And their children get married and children. It doesn't take long before you have a city, the way population grows. And in the same way, the choices that I make that affect my children, they also affect 10, 15, 20 generations ahead. There's things about a person's life that are passed on from generation to generation to generation until and unless they're broken by faith in God and the chain is broken. I have a real mystery. Since I'm Jewish, I can't go back very far in my family genealogy. You know, some people, I know one guy whose family has been living in Maryland since the early 1700s. So you can go back pretty far. But since I'm Jewish, if I go back to my great-grandparents, I know they came from Russia to the United States, and so I can't go any further. If I wanted to, I'd have to go to Russia, and I might not find anything there. Now, I have certain things about my personality that I question. And I look at my father, I see I'm a lot like him physically. I'm built like he is. I look at my mother, I look at my sisters, my aunts, my uncles, my grandparents, and I have certain psychological issues that I cannot trace to any of my family. But somewhere back somewhere, one of my forefathers had a personality trait that I inherited. He may have lived 500 years ago, but his life affected me. And in the same way, we can certainly say, we can extend that to say Adam and Eve lived, I don't know, 6,000 years ago or so. And we know what they did affected everybody. So these words that Moses is speaking here, the word choose is the most important word in the verse. If somebody gets you involved in the free will versus sovereignty argument, just say to them, look, this is not worth arguing about. What we do know is what the Bible tells us, and it tells us to make a choice. And if we stand around arguing about free will versus sovereignty, that's just the way it begs the question. It's a way of getting around the choice that we all have to make. Because whether we stand before God at the judgment seat of Christ or at the white throne judgment is ultimately going to be determined by a choice that we have made. So it doesn't make too much difference to me where you want to stand on the free will issue. What matters to me is, what do you choose for yourself? The 12 verses 13 and 32... Let me make a little note. The 12 verses 13 and 32, sons of Jacob, are divided into two groups throughout the narrative. There are the 10 of Joseph's brothers in verse 3, and the two sons of Jacob by Rachel, Joseph and Benjamin. And it does seem as though Jacob had deeper feelings for Joseph and Benjamin because they were the wife of his first love. I mean, the sons of his first love. These two sons of Rachel are contrasted with the two sons of Leah, Reuben, and Judah in the narrative. Now, one thing we want to keep in mind as we go through this, because what we're going to be reading about now is the brothers going up to Egypt and meeting with Joseph for the first time since they sold him into slavery. And when you read it, it might seem as though Joseph is vengeful, that he wants revenge, that he's being mean to his brothers, but he's not. He's being very gracious to his brothers because he's a very godly man. And he knows that his brothers have been living under a shadow of guilt for a number of years. And he doesn't want that for his brothers. And so he's not looking for revenge. What he wants to do is bring them to a point where that shadow of guilt becomes so heavy a load that they come to repentance and find peace. You know, when somebody lives a life of sin, what does it say? There is no peace for the wicked. And if somebody is under a cloud of guilt, you can give them all the antidepressants you want. Did you know that if you ask any psychologist, what brings people into your office the most? What problems do you see in people? And a lot of them will say guilt. And psychologists can tell you what's wrong with you, but you know what they can't do? They can't fix it. Because the fix is here. And very few psychologists follow this book. They follow what they learned in graduate school. Both Reuben and Judah play an important and similar role in the narrative. They speak on behalf of the other brothers and are the catalyst in the resolution of the plots instigated by Joseph. Okay. It was Judah, however, who saved the day by offering himself as a pledge, guarantee for the young lad Benjamin. And it was Judah who repeated Jacob's own thematic words, that we and you and our children not die. Judah was the one, remember, he offered to be the pledge, the guarantee. Joseph said, you go back and bring your younger brother here, and then I'll know you're not lying to me. Otherwise, you won't see my face again. And of course, the brothers knew, how can we do that? Our father Jacob would never let Benjamin leave his sight. But Joseph was adamant. He put them below. We're going to read. I don't want to get ahead of myself. Hey, verses 5 through 15. So the sons of Israel came to buy grain among those who were coming, for the famine in the land of Canaan was in the land of Canaan also. Now Joseph was the ruler over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land. You know, if you went up to Pharaoh at the end of a day and just said to Pharaoh, how much grain did you sell? I don't know. Go ask Joseph. So, now Joseph was ruler over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. When Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he disguised himself to them and spoke to them harshly. And he said to them, where have you come from? And they said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. Now, it might be absurd that they wouldn't recognize him, but bear in mind, first of all, Jewish men grew full-length beards in those days. Egyptians were clean-shaven. They dressed completely differently than Jewish people did. So it's not really surprising they didn't recognize Joseph. He probably looked, and he was older, he probably looked a lot different from when they threw him in the pit. But Joseph recognized his brothers. They looked the same. When Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he disguised himself to them and spoke to them harshly and said to them, where have you come from? And they said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. But Joseph had recognized his brothers, although they did not recognize him. Joseph remembered the dreams which he had about them and said to them, you are spies. You have come to look at the undefended parts of our land. Now notice something. What's motivating Joseph right now? The dreams he had. He remembered the dreams he had, and that's what's motivating him right now, that he would rule over his brothers. And it's the dreams that God set in his mind are coming true. Then they said to him, no, my lord, but your servants have come to buy food. His brothers must have been scared to death. First of all, I think I'd be a little nervous if I had to go and have a question and answer period with a king. That'd be very nerve-wracking, especially when you're starting off with a big cloud of guilt over your head. And you know that you deserve death. And somewhere it might be lurking around the corner. Then they said to him, no, my lord, but your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants are not spies. Yet he said to them, no, but you have come to look at the undefended parts of our land. But they said, your servants are 12 brothers. See how he's like backing them into a corner here? And sometimes it's just human nature, but when people really, really get backed into a corner who are living a lie, sometimes they start to tell the truth because they know there's no other way out. They know a lie is just going to get them back further into the corner. So, then they said to him, no, my lord, but your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants are not spies. Yet he said to them, no, but you have come to look at the undefended parts of our land. But they said, your servants are 12 brothers in all, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, now this is important in the translation. The youngest is with our father today, and one is no longer alive. Does anybody have a translation that doesn't read like that? What does it say? That's not the correct translation. This is the first time they're actually admitting verbally he's dead. They're not just saying no more. They're being completely honest. A literal translation of the Hebrew is, one is no longer alive. And it happens again later in the chapter. What is that, the NIV? Yeah. Later in the chapter, you're going to see the same thing happening. And this is the first time they're verbalizing that their brother is dead. Okay? Okay, page 153. The 10 brothers come before Joseph. Throughout the narrative, then, the plot is woven around the interplay between Joseph and Judah. And in the end, it was Judah who resolved the conflict. By the same token, it was Joseph who created the conflict and tension throughout the narrative. When his brothers approached him to buy grain, he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly, accusing them of being spies. Now, why would he do that? They weren't spies, and he knew they weren't spies. But he was doing that, and a really right way to look at it is God was working through Joseph to bring his brothers back to himself. You know what it says in Proverbs? A murderer will be a wanderer all his life. Let no man support him. I think that these 10 brothers, from the time they sold Joseph until this very day, were men who had deep depressions. I don't see how it could be otherwise. If I were a young man and did foolhardy things, and I set my brother up, I don't have a brother, but I set my brother up to go and be a slave for the rest of his life somewhere, eventually it would have to catch up with me. And I might become an alcoholic. There's no way I could have a healthy marriage or be a healthy father to children. And my children would grow up being a man like me. When his brothers approached him to buy grain, he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly, accusing them of being spies. Okay, moving on. Joseph was not merely trying to get even with his brothers for what they had done to him. Moses immediately pushed aside such a possibility with the comment that Joseph remembered his dreams about them. Thus, the reader is advised that Joseph's schemes and plans against his brothers were motivated by the dreams of the earlier narratives and not by what his brothers had done to him. You see that? He's not looking at his brothers and says, look what you did to me, and now I'm really in a position to get you back for it. That's not what's motivating him. What's motivating him is the dreams that he had. And he realizes, it's not that he's power hungry, but he realizes that God has put him in an exalted position so that his family might be saved. And so we have to be careful when we determine what his motives are in what he's doing. Little more is said specifically regarding the purpose Joseph saw in his continuous schemes to perplex his brothers. But subtle reminders throughout the narrative further reveal his intention. For example, in response to Joseph's accusation that the brothers were spies, the brothers defended their integrity by saying, "Your servants were 12 brothers, but lest their integrity be questioned, they were forced to add, and one is no more." And I just took that, which I really, sometimes if you put things in quotations, if you change them, you have to put brackets, and it gets a little confusing to read. But it should really read, one is no longer alive. That's what the literal Hebrew says. Joseph's schemes had provoked the first hint of their evil deed accomplished in the distant past may still rise up against them. You know, it's not all that unusual for someone, let's take a man in his mid-40s, and nothing's going right. And he finally gets to the point, and we all get to that point if we're in that position where we say, why is God doing this to me? When our lives become in such disarray that we lose control over our own lives, and we can't find anyone to blame, we blame God, we don't blame ourselves. Why is God doing this to me? But if we take that attitude, then we're not perceiving God as we should, and we're never going to escape from whatever chains are holding on to us. There's a reason God is doing what he's doing in everybody's life. And the ultimate reason that God is doing what he is doing in the life of every person on earth is to bring them into relationship with himself. That's what he wants to do, so that he may bless them. If someone is not a believer, it is God's desire that they come to him in repentance. If someone is a believer, it's his desire that they grow in a relationship with him. As proof that this point was not lost on the brothers, Moses allows us to listen in on the brothers' own version of this event when they recount it to their father. On that occasion, they reported their own words in a different order than that of the narrative in verse 13. See what their conscience is doing to them. Their conscience is bringing it to the forefront. So instead of keeping this, one is no longer alive, instead of keeping that at the end, probably even looking down and not saying it very loud, now it's coming to the forefront. Yes? Yeah, but probably there's two possibilities. One possibility is that they were speculating. That's a possibility. The other possibility is, and it's a real possibility, slaves didn't live very long lives. This is quite a while after they sold him into slavery. And they had no idea what happened to him. But if God blessed him by making him the steward of Potiphar's house. That would be an enviable position for a slave. But as a rule, slaves did not live very long lives at all. And I'll give you an example of that. Football players in the NFL, the average lifespan of an NFL football player is somewhere in the 40s. They don't live very long because of the way their bodies get beat up. But you are right. They may be speculating. They may be covering themselves, telling the story as bad as it can be, so there's no chance. I mean, which would be worse for them, to say he's alive and then they found out he's dead, or to say he's dead and they found out he's alive? They probably, Pharaoh and the man that they don't know is Joseph, would probably look more favorably over an error in their reporting to them if they said he's dead and then they find out he's alive and they rejoice, then he's alive and it turns out he's dead. They would think now he's lying to us. They're lying to us, yes? No, they didn't use the word death. They used not alive.
Okay, they use the word
Now, it may be an idiom. I don't know. You got to be careful when you go from one language to another. For example, let me give you an example. If I were to come to you and you said to me, I got to go see Bob for a few minutes, then I'll be back in class. And I said to you, he's falling asleep. You'd figure, okay, I'll see him a little later, right? But in the first century, that was an idiom. What did Jesus mean when he said to his disciples, Lazarus has fallen asleep? It was an idiom for death. So it is possible that the Hebrew word alive is not there, but the construction, the Hebrew construction, then is idiomatic and representative of death. I know the word death is not in there, dead. That's not in there. You're right. Okay, let's take our first break. Okay. This will take it. Let me just read this section real quickly, and then we'll go back to where we were. The narrative account the brothers mentioned first. In the narrative account, the brothers mention first the one who is no more. But when they tell their father about Joseph's accusation and their response, they mention last the one who is no more, and then tell of Benjamin, who was home with his father. Though subtle, such a reversal appears to be a narrative hint that the memory of what they did to Joseph was beginning to rubble in their conscience. And as I said, you can't escape your conscience. It's not possible to do that. Though the readers know it was Joseph who had the money put back in their sacks, their words point us to the work of God, serving to confirm the direction of the narrative as a whole appears to be taken. God is at work in the schemes of Joseph, and we're allowed to see in this narrative a preliminary reminder of the ultimate theme. God intended it for good. And what I was going to say is, suppose Jesus came up to you one day and you knew it was him. He made himself known to you and he said to you, let's say it was Monday, and he said to you, I'm going to be passing through your town on Wednesday and I'd like to have dinner with you. And of course, you'd be thrilled. So this is a little allegory, by the way. I'll say that at the beginning. So you go home, and what's the first thing you do? You start to clean your house. And there's a few things in the house that are a little junky and some rooms that aren't quite clean, and you realize I'm not really going to be able to get this thing by Wednesday to look really, really nice. So you go up into the attic, and in the attic there's a big closet. And so you take all the junk and all the litter and all the stuff and you just bring it up there and you stick it in that closet and close the door. Now the house looks beautiful. So Wednesday comes and Jesus comes, knocks on your door and come in, and Jesus comes in and you say to Jesus, let me show you around my house. And Jesus says to you, okay, the first thing I'd like to see is the closet in the attic. Metaphor. Okay. Joseph tests his brothers. Joseph's explanation of the change in plans also ties the narrative to the larger themes of the book. He said about his plan, do this and you will live, that you may not die, which aligns the narrative with the theme of life and death that runs throughout the Torah. When the brothers began to talk among themselves about the distress they had brought on Joseph, the reader can get a glimpse of where Joseph's plans are leading. Reuben's words focus our attention on the central point of the narrative. Now we must give an accounting for his blood. They see it. Their eyes are opened. At this point, we can see that Joseph's plans should be, were not in revenge for how his brothers once treated him. Rather, they are to show how, in God's world, the guilt of the brothers came back on them and called for justice. That's exactly what happened. The remarkable message of the narrative, however, is that Joseph had already forgiven his brothers for the evil they had done to him. As verse 24 shows, Joseph had to turn away from them to hide his sorrow for the distress his plan now caused. What awaited his brothers was not the evil they intended for Joseph, but the good God intended for them through Joseph. And I'm sure we who are parents can identify with this. When my daughter was like about 3-4 years old, she was the most beautiful little thing I'd ever seen. And we're all like that as parents. And when she would misbehave and I would correct her and the lower lip would start to quiver, I would almost start to cry. I mean, I know I was doing the right thing. You know, you shouldn't climb up on the stove or whatever. But that lower lip thing, I couldn't take. It's too much for me. Okay, anyway, Joseph's next plan, verses 25 to 28. Then Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain and to restore every man's money in his sack and to give them provisions for the journey. And thus it was done for them. So they loaded their donkeys with their grain and departed from there. As one of them opened his sack to give his donkey fodder at the lodging place, he saw his money, and behold, it was in the mouth of his sack. Then he said to his brothers, "My money has been returned, and behold, it is even in my sack." And their hearts sank. And they turned trembling to one another, saying, and here they go again, "What is this that God has done to us?" And the thing is, they're right. They're not right in the way they're interpreting their position, but they're right. God is the one who is bringing this into their lives. God is doing something to them. What they don't realize is that what he's doing for them is for their own benefit. Okay. Joseph's next plan was to fill the brothers' sacks with the money they had brought to buy grain. Though nothing is said about Joseph's intention, the word of the brothers, as they discovered, were all that the narrative required. What is this that God has done to us? The reader knows that it was Joseph who put the money in their sacks, but the brothers give expression to the underlying point of the narrative. God was behind it all, and through it all was working out his purpose. And ultimately his purpose was that his people should survive the famine. And when we're not there yet, but I'll read it now. When we get to the end of the story about Joseph and his brothers, look what Joseph's going to say in the last chapter of Genesis. "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive." That's what was really going on. All these ups and downs and betrayals and lies and suffering and everything else, God intended it for good. And in the end, it preserved Jacob's family and the Jewish people. If the brothers had never, not that they're not responsible for what they did, they were, clearly, we see they're being called to task for it, but if the brothers had never thrown Joseph in a pit, there might not be a Jewish people today, and God couldn't have that. So what they meant for evil, God turned it around and meant it for good. Okay, what do I do here?